Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. For Sac State's new president, there wasn't really a settling in period. From the day President Luke Wood arrived on campus, he was tasked with overcoming some big obstacles that could jeopardize the success of the university. From stalled negotiations and labor strikes for faculty and staff that is still ongoing, to steering Cap Radio, which is an auxiliary of the university, off a financial cliff. Less than 6 months in, President Wood's time has been filled with big tests, but it's not all crises. There were also highlights and some big milestones to look forward to. So President Wood is joining us now with an outlook for 2024, the new year. Welcome back to Insight.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, we've talked about this before, but you do have this unique perspective coming in as president. I mean, you're a Sac State graduate, both your undergrad and master's. You left to get your PhD. You came back to us from San Diego State, which is part of the Cal State family. So you have like this insider, outsider, insider perspective, not to mention the youngest president in Sac State history. So in the past 5 months and change that you've actually been in this position, did it meet your expectations? Is it what you envisioned it to be?
Very much so. I mean, obviously, some of the unique challenges weren't expected. But at the same time, whenever you assume a leadership role like this, you know that there's going to be things that aren't what you expect. And that's part of it. But I think one of the best parts about coming back was spending a semester getting reacquainted with Sacramento State and seeing so many people who are part of my own journey, faculty members, staff members who are still on campus, who are still, you know, fighting the good fight for our students, and even people who I went to school with who are now on staff or on faculty just doing great work. So it was a pretty enjoyable transition home.
Given that you already had this familiarity and that kind of foundation already set, when you arrived on campus, I remember you mentioning that you were going to go on a listening tour, 100 days of listening. What did you learn and did anything surprise you?
Yeah, so the listening tour was pretty extensive. And part of it, what it was, is when you come back into an environment, you should never make an assumption, right? Being a student at Sacramento State is not the same thing as being in a presidential role. And so I wanted to have the opportunity to hear from our students, our faculty, our staff, our alumni, our community members, our religious communities, and to just have an understanding of like what has been their experience. And we asked them a few questions. So the first one was, what makes Sacramento State distinctive? The second one was, where do you want to see Sacramento State 5 years from now or even tomorrow? And what are the specific things you want us to do to get there? And then how do we accomplish all that while embracing our values of justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion? And we did 92 listening sessions, an hour and 15 minutes each. So pretty extensive, over 1,500 people that we had conversations with, and just learned a lot about the campus and some really good things. You know, a lot of people come to Sacramento State, of course, because we're in the state capital, because we have a beautiful park-like campus, because we're a campus that people feel like they're not just going to be a number, but they're going to be a name. They're going to be a future, that there's faculty members who are going to invest their time in them. And that was a really nice thing to hear, not only just from the students, but also from the faculty members about, you know, what is it is that brought them here. So there was a lot of really wonderful things that we learned that draw people to Sacramento State and make it unique. And also, of course, as I'm hearing all this, I'm reflecting on my own experience. Why did I choose Sacramento State when I was a young kid? And a lot of it was for the same reason. I wanted to work at the state capitol and get some of that experience. And I'm from the mountains. And so coming to a campus that looks like a park is felt very comfortable and just welcoming. And then the diversity of students, it was just, you know, an enjoyable experience. And hearing people say the same things, it says that, you know, Sacramento State, the great things about it have staying power.
Yeah, more than 100 hours of listening you ended up doing. When it came to challenges and, you know, where people were dissatisfied, what did you gain from that? What did you learn?
Yeah, there were certainly challenges. Of course, Capital Public Radio came up as part of those challenges and concerns, you know, rightfully so, as we discussed before. We also heard about, you know, there being bureaucratic red tape that's in place that prevents a lot of really good work from getting done. And that, you know, there can at times be a culture of no because of the bureaucracy that has been created. And so one of the things that we said that we were going to do, and we released this to the campus community, is that we're going to have a bureaucratic reduction committee that's going to look at our policies, our processes, how we can streamline things, just to make it so that it's an easier to get good work done. And so that was one of the big things that we heard. We also heard about, you know, lack of resources. And, you know, we're a public institution. We are dependent upon the state for the resources that we have. And unfortunately, we are not resourced to in the way that we need to be to do the good work that we're doing. And so that causes strain on employees. That causes a lot of stress for people. And so there was a lot of conversation around that. And of course, the backdrop of that is also the tuition increase that took place for students. The system voted for a 6% increase over the next 5 years. And then at the same time, as you mentioned, we're going through labor negotiations with our faculty union and with our Teamsters and other unions. And so there's the backdrop of all that placed against the fact that we struggle with resources to do the good work that we're already doing.
When it comes to the collective bargaining groups at the university, I understand that like CSU management, it really handles the negotiations and that's above you. But last month when Sacramento was among, you know, four universities that took part in rolling strikes, this is at the beginning of December, you know, given that you've been a professor, your wife is a professor as well, does their message about better pay and benefits, does it resonate with you?
Well, I had come up from a union background. So one of my first jobs was working for the California Faculty Association. And then I worked for AFSCME, American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. I worked for ACORN, worked for SEIU. So I have, I think, a union upbringing. And so for me, it's always been important that when people are doing work, that they should be properly compensated for that work. And so I am always attentive to the fact that we need to make sure that that's happening. And then, you know, the proximity for me in this, you know, having that background and then having my wife currently be a member of the faculty union and then meeting regularly in this role as president with all of our unions and our represented employees, you know, it's a very close conversation to me. Yet at the same time, as you mentioned, this is all done at the state level. So the system does all the negotiation and we are simply the recipients of those decisions that are made. And they're wrestling with a lot of difficult decisions, right? How do we pay for increases? How do we make sure that people are properly honored for the work that they're doing? And that balance and trying to find the balance is a hard part because we want to, we have to be able to have the resources to do the good work that we're doing. Mm-hmm. So when the strike took place, as you mentioned, there was four campuses. Sacramento State was chosen. It was a one-day strike, and we definitely saw a reduction in activity on campus. And, you know, the entrances there were, you know, partially closed at times during the day when that was occurring. And we know that there is an upcoming one-week strike that's going to take place during the first week of school. And so, you know, for me, the main thing is making sure that our campus is engaged in planning to be prepared for that, to make sure that students are getting what they need and what they deserve. And at the same time, also respecting the right that representative employees have to strike.
Yeah, so that week-long strike, which I believe is scheduled to take place January 22nd, which is, you know, the start of the first week of classes, that's both the California Faculty Association in tandem with the Teamsters. But from what I understood from their press release, it depends on negotiations next week. And if they're not fruitful, then that strike will commence.
Yes, and that's accurate. And so, of course, I hope that those negotiations, that the distance between both the system and their unions is met somewhere in the middle. And so that's what I'm hoping for.
How do you plan as a university president, given that it's the first week of classes?
Well, it's a difficult thing to do. I mean, we have a coordination committee that's been working tirelessly on this. And there's so many different elements to it, even down to we have, you know, boilers on campus. And what happens if we don't have people to run the boilers?
Yeah, so building service engineers, right?
Yeah, I mean, so the level of detail and intricacy that you have to get down to when it comes to something like this is pretty significant. And I'll say that it certainly a one-day strike is reasonable to manage. A one-week strike is very difficult to manage. And so we're thinking through every single option. We have meetings all throughout this week trying to figure out how we're going to navigate that and ensure that the students are supported and the students are served, which is why we're here. And at the same time, acknowledging the fact that we're going to have a substantial reduction in those who are coming to work.
I want to move to another big responsibility of yours and a problem that you inherited, and that's here at CAP Radio. So the last time you joined us, it was back in October. That followed layoffs in August, as well as an audit detailing just massive financial problems and debt that is ultimately the university's responsibility. Back then in October, you said that 70 to 75% of your time is devoted to CAP Radio issues. What percentage is that now?
It's more like 40% now, but so there's been a reduction. But that being said, when it comes to what are the things that keep me up at night, it's always going to be the number one thing. CAP Radio is, in my mind, it's part of the educational mission of the university. So yes, it is totally separate entity. It is an auxiliary. It operates on its own, and that's important for that, that journalistic firewall. And at the same time, it's putting information out to the public. It's informing the public in that way. It is part of the educational mission of the university. And so for me, it was important to make sure that CAP Radio would be able to continue, that it would be healthy, that it would thrive. And at the same time, we were coming, as I walked in the door, being handed a report from our chancellor's office saying that this is, the worst audit in the system's history, and that there's some significant existential issues here. And so, at that time, we were looking at, CAP Radio running out of money sometime in January or early February. Now, I think that there's been some really good moves have been able to make that so that stretches out to April. And so I'm hoping that we continue to have the donors to CAP Radio come back and have trust that what's happening now is different than what happened in the past, and that the importance of public media moving forward into this presidential election season into 2024 is going to be the most important year to have CAP Radio in place, to have objective journalism that's being reported, because at this point, I don't think that you can trust a lot of the things that you hear in national media. You have to be able to have people who are committed to independence and true journalism, which is unfortunately not what we see at the national level. And so I'm hoping that more of our donors will see that and continue to support CAP Radio.
And in the spirit of that firewall, it's important to just remind people that, we report on ourselves independently.
Yeah.
It's not like you and I talk beforehand or when we have the interim GM of CAP Radio on as well. And so there is that objectivity and that firewall. But there's also these key leadership positions that are still vacant. We still don't have a permanent GM as well as a complete board of directors. Is there a timeline when those positions will be filled?
Absolutely. So with the board of directors, that will be filled at the next meeting of CAP Radio. The only reason that it has taken so long for that is because we had to make sure that we were doing due diligence with background checks, conflict of interest checks, and a number of background factors that were really part of what some of the concerns were from the previous board. And that takes time to do that right and to not run into some of the same concerns that were there before. So one of the beautiful parts about it was that, we put out there that we were going to be looking for new board members, and it was amazing the response from people who wanted to be on the board, despite the challenges, despite what was being reported in the news, that people were so committed, that incredible people in our community who are leaders in our community standing forward and saying, I want to be on the CAP Radio board because I want to be part of the solution. And so I think we had almost 40 people who were nominated to be part of the board. And so there's been a pretty extensive vetting process. We have an external firm that's looking at individuals, again, doing those background checks and just lots of conversation. So I feel very proud of where we're at right now, and the fact that CAP Public Radio is going to have a board that's in place. The CAP Radio has listenership that's been up, the agreement with NPR has been extended. Like, there's been some, despite all the challenges that we've talked about before, there's also a lot of really good things happening right now. And I would say that one of the markers of that success is if you're a listener, and I'm a listener myself, right, and you turn on CAP Radio, you're hearing nothing but great quality coming out. So despite the challenges that have been there, the staff have done amazing work in continuing to produce high quality news.
You mentioned though that Cap Radio still keeps you up at night. I mean, because we're talking about, you know, several billion million dollars in the hole. And on top of that, you know, given that you're a public university, you are state funded. And so the state is facing a projected deficit of like $68 billion. And Governor Newsom is expected to announce revisions and cuts next week. So is there a concern of the impact of public education ultimately impacting faculty and students?
Well, I think the budget concern, separate from Cap Radio, is absolutely a concern for us, knowing that we could receive a reduction and being concerned about how we're going to do that. Again, in combination with all those things we just discussed, we just had a tuition increase. We're having labor negotiations that are taking place right now. We already don't have a lot of resources to do the good work that we're doing. So that in and of itself is its own pool of considerations and problems. And then, of course, adding on Cap Radio to that, that's also a concern. I think, though, that the markers of success in terms of listenership, in terms of the extension of the contract with NPR, I think that what will happen is that more donors will recognize the importance of coming and continuing to support Cap Radio. So I feel confident that that Cap Radio will be vibrant in the future. You know, we went all in saying that we're committed to Cap Radio and that we're going to continue to support it, and we are. That doesn't mean that every part of that support is not going to be difficult to do. And, you know, it means that we're going to have to look at our institution as a whole, and in some places we'll have to tighten our belt. And that's okay, because, again, this is part of the educational mission of the institution. Now, I will say that, you know, there is the forensic examination that's taking place. And the forensic examination is looking at the past. My focus right now, of course, is on the future, but we do have to look retrospectively and see what were the things that led to us being in such a disastrous standpoint. And unfortunately, I think that we're gonna see some stuff come out of that.
Could be expected like at the end of this month, potentially,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. Actually, it will be sometime in this month that we'll have at least the preliminary findings. And I'll say that we've also, as a campus, of course, been working with the forensic examination firm, providing them with additional information, pooling information that we've been able to find. And I could say that we don't have any preliminary findings yet, but I can look at even the information that we're providing. There's concerns, and those concerns are again about the past and about what happened in the past. But
will that translate to accountability?
It's going to have to.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Sacramento State President Luke Wood. So we just have about 5 minutes left. So I'm curious, looking ahead now, do you have like a mantra or a guiding intention for 2024?
Yeah, student success. You know, and that was one of the things that President Nelson, I think, did so wonderfully, is he focused so much on helping the campus to think about how do we increase graduation rates. You know, went from 8.5% graduation rate to a 28.5% graduation rate. And so that's one marker of success is graduation rates. But what I continue to hear from the listening tours is it's also about employability and labor market outcomes. So there's a few things that we're doing in my mind that's going to help us get there. One, we've got a program that's been on campus for a long time. In fact, I was part of it when I was a student, called Cooper Woodson College. And Cooper Woodson College is an achievement program focused on students who identify as Black and African American. Open, of course, to everyone, but that's kind of the demographic that it tends to serve. And so we are resourcing that program. We're providing them with more staff, with more dollars, with additional space. Because our graduation rate might be 28.5% for the four-year rate, much higher for the six-year, but it's only 10.5% for our Black male students. So it's much lower. But when you look at Cooper Woodson, they have incredibly high graduation rates and they do an amazing job. So why don't we invest in what's working? And so we are expanding that program. We're investing that program, and we will create what will be what we believe is the first Black honors college in the country. And so I'm excited about that. That's going to be part of our narrative in 2024. 2024, you're going to see more from Sacramento State.
And there's a lot to come in 2024. I mean, there's just reading on the university's website, from, you know, faculty and staff housing to you appointed a czar for AI in education, yep. Some developments with the California Mobility Center, you know, tons of things that deserve a segment on their own, as well as a new event center. But an interesting note, I think I saw you post this on social media. You're an amateur boxer and you've talked about reviving Sacramento State's boxing program. How is that going?
It's going well, actually. So we have a boxing team from way back when. Sacramento State used to have an amazing boxing team. And, you know, I'll first say that we're not the only ones who exist in this space. UC Davis has a boxing program, San Jose State, Berkeley, UCLA used to have one. So it's not unusual for a campus to have a boxing program. But I think what makes it special is that we have some just amazing alumni who are actually, you know, professional boxers. One is Kevin Montano. He's fighting on January 20th at the Doubletree. And he was actually an Olympic alternate. And so, you know, I'm going to be there. I'm going to be checking it out. But we've got, you know, a pool of individuals who've graduated from the campus who are doing great work. But one of the most important things about announcing that boxing was coming back was I had a mother. She walked up to me and she was very emotional. And she said, and she started crying and saying, you know, I'm so thankful that, you know, you're bringing back boxing to Sacramento State. My two sons have never once, not ever, talked about wanting to go to college or even thought about college. But now, for the first time, they're saying, hey, I want to go to Sacramento State. Because if you go to your average boxing gym, it's low-income students, it's first-generation students, students who for them, college is not even on the horizon. And so what this is really doing is it's creating a pathway into college for students who would never before consider it. And that's part of our mission as an institution, is to create access and success. And so part of that is boxing at Sacramento State.
Yeah, I've been part of a fighting gym, you know, many in a past life. So I understand that. You know, finally, President Wood, if you could talk to yourself ahead of arriving to the university this past summer, what advice would you give yourself with hindsight?
I would give myself the advice of you don't have to do everything at once. When you see a campus like Sacramento State that has so many great things happening, but also issues that need to be solved, it's easy to want to just jump in. And I think what I learned from the listening sessions is you have to continue to listen and to learn, because sometimes things that don't make sense make more sense as you hear the history of why that happened. And then sometimes you learn that things that you thought made sense don't make sense at all because of the history that happened. And so I would definitely say that the best decision was to do the listening tour. And so now I'm looking forward to this 2024. We're going to start implementing some change. And there's going to be a lot of big announcements coming out, some of them even this month. And so I think you're going to be proud of what you see come out of Sacramento State.
From listening to action.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, President Wood.
Thank you for having me.
And that is Sacramento State President Luke Wood on his outlook for the new year. And as I mentioned, Cap Radio is an auxiliary of the university. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Among the hundreds of new laws that have gone into effect in 2024, several deal with public safety. As we continue our annual breakdown of new laws, today we're going to take a look at two specific pieces of legislation related to policing and driving on California roads, which impacts many drivers across the state. One changes the way a police officer can interact with a driver during a traffic stop, and the other launches a pilot program that installs speeding cameras in certain California cities. case. CAP Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon joins us now with more about these laws, as well as additional updates on business at the state capitol in the new year. Good morning, Nicole.
Good morning.
Okay, so before we dive into these new laws, what were some of the major themes when it came to public safety within the California legislature last year?
I think the debate we saw kind of burst open in the legislature last year was really about criminal penalties. You know, this goes back decades when California is at the forefront of this tough on crime mentality, that lock them up and throw away the key. Huge reversal since then. Democratic state leaders are, you know, have really changed their tune on that. They're closing prisons. They're favoring rehabilitation. And they're very cautious about raising criminal penalties. This was a big debate last year, especially when it came to retail theft and fentanyl drug dealers. So I think that that's something we'll continue to see this year. They've kind of worked around the edges. But I think this debate over like whether to raise criminal penalties for certain issues will continue. And there's a racial justice element to that also. You know, that big question will be, will they approve stiffer criminal penalties in certain cases? And a lot of lawmakers in that criminal justice camp are very reluctant to do that. So I think that's the big sort of debate as far as public safety right now.
When it came to new laws for this year, you focused on two. The first one was Assembly Bill 2773, and it deals with traffic stops by law enforcement. So what does this change?
Well, it changes the very first interaction you have with the police officer, the first thing they say to you. And this applies to pedestrian and traffic stops. So that that changes if you're stopped by an officer, they can no longer come up to you and ask you, do you know why I stopped you? They'll have to state the reason for the stop before they ask you any questions.
Hmm. What prompted this change?
Well, it's meant to reduce racial profiling and escalation, two very big issues in policing over the past few years. I looked at a recent study that analyzed body camera footage of more than 500 police interactions with Black drivers. It found that the very first verbal exchanges can influence the outcome of a stop. So if an officer issues a command in the first like 45 words, that stop is more likely to escalate in a handcuffing or an arrest. If the officer states the reason for the stop at the outset, that interaction is much less likely to result in any sort of escalation.
And this really focuses on, as you said, like the first words that said between an officer and a driver or a pedestrian. Does this law have any other major changes?
There's a data tracking element of this. You know, the other requirement is a police officer will have to tell you the reason for the stop, and that will have to match the reason given on any issued citation. That will go to you. That information will also go to the state for law enforcement agencies that report to the Attorney General's office.
Are there any exceptions?
Yes. If an officer believes there's an imminent threat to life or property, I think, you know, this law is really aimed at those routine stops. It's less about what happens if police are after or catch an armed suspect or something like that.
You know, this is obviously now it is a new state law. But as it was moving through the legislature, was there any pushback or criticism?
There was a little bit of pushback from some law enforcement groups. They argued that gathering information at the outset of a stop is important for assessing risk and safety. They argued in an opposition letter that the bill is so strict that it prohibits an officer from asking for a person's ID or even asking a person to turn off their vehicle's ignition prior to disclosing the reason for the stop. And, you know, they said that gathering that information is important for safety for everybody.
Given that there are some exceptions when an officer wouldn't have to disclose why they are stopping someone, you know, how will the state or any governing agency monitor compliance with this new law?
I think that's the big question. You know, the state requires or wants law enforcement agencies to report a lot of information to the state every year. And you don't always see agencies doing that. Some of it is required by law. Some of it is just like they want this info, they ask for it. But agencies are not necessarily giving that information. So that is kind of a blind spot mm-hmm. in some of the areas here.
If it's found that, you know, an agency or a department isn't in compliance, are there consequences?
That's a good question.
We'll have to wait and see, right? It's January 3rd.
Yeah, just went into effect.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Cap Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon about new public safety laws that are now in effect in California. So the other public safety law in effect is Assembly Bill 645. And that actually is launching a new pilot program in some California cities to curb speeding on surface roads. So tell us about it.
Yeah, this authorizes six cities in the Bay Area and Southern California to install cameras that will automatically ticket drivers that are speeding. So capture a speeding violation and send off a ticket. It's similar to a law that already allows cities to set up these cameras for red light violations. Mm.
And is this happening like on a freeway or is it's actually just on in neighborhoods, right?
Correct. These cameras are not allowed on freeways. They're only allowed on city roads in specific areas like school zones, safety corridors, areas that the city has already determined where speeding is a concern to really target certain areas.
So when is fast too fast? What's the rule?
The penalties are kind of on a sliding scale here. So $50 violation if you're going 11 to 15 miles an hour, you won't get a ticket for anything under 10 or under, I guess, you know, $100 for 16 to 25 miles an hour over the speed limit, all the way up to $500 ticket for going 100 miles an hour over the speed limit, which on a city street is crazy.
Yeah. I mean, when it comes to, I mean, we already have, you know, this basic speed law, like we see, like, you know, when you're driving past a school or whatever, how fast you should be going, given the conditions. So what was the argument for installing this pilot, these speeding cameras?
Right. Well, I think because it's a pilot, you know, there's an element of wanting to gather information, start small and see how it works. So, first of all, supporters of this bill argue that the cameras reduce speeding. They point to data gathered by the National Transportation Safety Board that shows that in cities that where these cameras are posted, they've reduced speeding violations and crashes resulting in injuries from anywhere from 8% to like 49%. So there is an argument that these, you know, save lives. And the other part of this bill is that the cities have to collect data and show that they work. So there's a lot of data reporting required about whether how much speeding violations and traffic incidents are reduced. I think the state will look at that data in a few years and decide where to go from there, whether to expand this program or not.
Was there any criticism or pushback for this new law?
Yes. There were a few groups, the ACLU and Human Rights Watch, which wrote some letters in opposed to this bill. They listed concerns that the bill would entrench surveillance in certain communities, especially communities where more people of color live. Also that the cameras could violate privacy. The Human Rights Watch pointed to a similar program in Chicago where they say between 2015 and 2019, speed cameras ticketed households in majority Black and Latinx zip codes at twice the rate of majority white zip codes. And the author of this bill said there are provisions to require these cameras be placed in areas that are geographically and socioeconomically diverse. And then as far as the privacy issues goes, the bill requires cameras to be angled in a specific way so it captures just the back of the vehicle and not identifying information for drivers. But some of these critics say that's vague and they're skeptical that will actually protect anyone's privacy.
Yeah, and that's why that data is important because this is a pilot. So how long is this pilot going to last?
Yeah, it goes until 2032 or 5 years. So the law's in effect now. The cities are free to set up these programs, but I think it'll take some time for them to, you know, make sure they're in compliance with all the rules, actually place the cameras. So we may not see that right away, but they have 5 years to have these installed and gather that data.
I mean, I think about like red light cameras, you know, when they first started, you know, they started small and then now they're pretty much found statewide. So there is a potential that this could expand in the coming years.
Yeah. And the other thing is, you know, I'm reminded of sometimes I'm using my Maps app and I'm alerted that there's a red light camera ahead. These speeding cameras also have to be posted and drivers are notified that they're going to be there.
Mm. You know, finally, Nicole, I mean, you have covered a lot of pieces of legislation. There was, you know, like, I mean, 800 bills that were signed into law and way more that were introduced. So, I mean, it wasn't just about public safety. You also covered a lot of other themes when it came to labor, workplace safety. So what are the highlights of the new changes there?
Yeah, a lot of new laws benefiting workers this year. I think the minimum wage is now $16 an hour, highest minimum wage in the country. Beginning in April, fast food workers are going to get their minimum wage bumped up to $20 an hour. There are concerns about how high that is and that it could lead to more automation and fewer jobs in that sector. But they are celebrating that win. Required paid sick leave goes up this year from a minimum of 3 days to 5 days that employers have to give workers. And there's now a ban on penalizing workers for their cannabis use outside the job. The only exceptions here are federal workers and construction workers were left out of that law.
Given that we have a new year and the legislature is going to be back in session, I mean, what are some of the themes that you're looking at, especially when it comes, last year was like the year of labor. So do you think that's going to be a continuation of that this year?
I think, well, labor got a lot of wins last year. I think it's hard to say. There's this big budget deficit hanging over state lawmakers this year. I think lawmakers are facing a lot of pressure to regulate AI, social media. There were some bills to place limits on social media companies last year that did not make it. They stalled out. So lawmakers have been doing a lot of work behind the scenes on those two issues. I think they're feeling the pressure to act, especially as other states have been passing bills to, you know, limit when kids are on social media, require age verification and parental consent and all of that.
Yeah. And I imagine just next week, the governor is expected to announce, you know, some revisions and cuts in light of this projected deficit. You joined us about it. It's like $68 billion. So I imagine you're closely following, you know, what big changes are in store and cuts are in store for the state.
Yeah, exactly. I think that will be the big topic for the next few months, at least, is what's on the chopping block for the $68 billion budget deficit.
Nicole, thank you.
Thank you.
Nicole Nixon is Cap Radio's politics reporter. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. 67%, that's how much Sacramento County's unhoused population grew between 2019 and 2022. The unprecedented numbers, nearly 9,300 people experiencing homelessness, it made headlines and pointed to an even larger number than San Francisco. This survey is called the Point in Time Count, and every 2 years, volunteers fan out across places like Sacramento County to try and count as many people living on the streets and in shelters. The numbers are then sent to the federal government, and that translates into funding for homelessness response. To get an accurate count, the nonprofit Sacramento Steps Forward is looking for hundreds of volunteers to canvass specific areas. Joining us now is Lisa Bates, the Chief Executive Officer of Sacramento Steps Forward. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
You and I have talked about the point in time count many times, but for someone who is unfamiliar with the purpose and the intention of this, talk to us about why this is done every 2 years.
This is a requirement of all communities across America to conduct a count of people that are both sheltered and unsheltered in our community every 2 years, at least every 2 years. Some communities do it annually. We do it every 2 years. The last time we conducted a count was in 2022. And the reason why this point in time count is so crucial for our community is, one, it gives us a really good barometer of of who's experiencing homelessness, how many people are experiencing homelessness, and what are some of the barriers and challenges that they face, because we have an opportunity to do interviews with people who are experiencing homelessness in addition to just the count as well. The second reason why it's really important for our community is that it helps determine what sort of resources we can receive both at the federal government and also increasingly the state is using the point in time count as a measure of how they distribute resources that they're providing for homelessness. The third reason is just it's really good data to have for our decision makers and for us to use in terms of what strategies and initiatives we have to deploy in order to reduce homelessness in our community.
Yeah, I mean, because it's one thing to experience it anecdotally, you know, in your own neighborhood, but that data is so important, and especially because it's not just physically counting, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, you're actually interviewing individuals as well. So how has this count over the years allowed your nonprofit and other community partners to just better understand the best way to address and solve homelessness in our region?
Well, the point in time count, in conjunction with data that we receive from providers, I think we have to recognize it as one data source, but there are other ways in which we collect information. But what it shares with us is whether or not we have certain interventions that are working or not, or if we see different trends that are occurring in terms of how many people are experiencing homelessness because of certain factors. For example, in the 22 point in time count, we saw that although our numbers increased significantly and we saw chronic homelessness rise, which is people that are on the street for a long period of time with disabling conditions, we also saw that an increased number of those individuals ended up accepting housing or shelter. And that was largely due to some initiatives that happened during COVID.
Like Project Room Key.
Project Room Key, to provide non-congregant sheltering. So it gave us some real insight that people will accept services, particularly if they're non-congregate. And so those little nuggets of information are super helpful to inform policy and decisions about where we need to focus our efforts and our resources.
And that is really just a snapshot in time, this point in time count. So when it was, you know, 9,300, I mean, that has been said to be even a conservative estimate. It's just what can be gathered over a 2-day period, correct?
The point in time count is just one data source. And yes, it only happens every couple of years in Sacramento, and it is just a point in time. So you need to couple that information with the data that we receive from our providers. And we've been doing a really good job in Sacramento with increasing the ability to access services through a coordinated access system. And so we're seeing much more data that complements the point in time count. But the point in time count is the federally recognized data that most communities point to see trends over time. So it helps you with knowing directionally where you are going as a community, and again, providing those really deep insights through the ability to interview up to 500 or 600 people on the 2 nights of the count.
Yeah. And this is, as you mentioned, a requirement of HUD, which is Housing and Urban Development. It's a federal agency. But this is also made possible largely because of volunteers. Talk to us about the crucial role that volunteers play in this process.
Yes, we couldn't do this without the tremendous support of the volunteers in the community. And every single time that we conduct the count, we see overwhelming response of support and help in conducting the count. This year, we are hoping to get 700 volunteers. We're at about 450, so we'll be making a big push these next few weeks to see if we can increase the number of people that can help us, because we want to get an accurate count as possible. We are conducting the count over 2 days, and we've also added satellite locations to some of the cities, so Citrus Heights and Elk Grove and Rancho Cordova. So if you're a community member in those communities and would like to survey within your own city, you have an opportunity to do that as well.
And this point in time count is taking place, I think, in about 3 weeks, right? The 24th and the 25th. So at the end of this month, if someone's listening, they're interested in taking part in this, what is the experience like for a volunteer?
Well, it's fairly easy to sign up. You go on the website, register. semester. There'll be a virtual training that we'll be offering in the next week or so. And then really you are able to come as yourself or as a team. We ask that to be no more than four in a team. And we will assign you an area within Sacramento County. And the expectation is that you will go out with your team and canvas that area, looking and counting for people. We have an app on a phone app that you will use. So it's very user-friendly to be able to record the information in terms of how many people you see, whether they're in tents or under bridges. And then if you are able to connect with someone who is willing to give you an interview, then there's a series of questions that we ask that you ask the individual or the family so that we can collect that information. Volunteers have shared that the experience is very rich and deep, and that they've learned so much about who's experiencing homelessness from their interactions and their conversations that they're able to have with people on those two nights.
If it is just a single individual, do they just go out by themselves, or do they get put into a group?
They get put into a group. So you don't have to come with a group, but you will be paired with other folks that are also not necessarily coming as a team.
And this takes place in the evening hours, correct?
It'll be from 5:30 to 11, and we have different deployment times that you can sign up on the site. The central location is here at Sacramento State at the Alumni Center, but we also have satellite locations. So depending on where you would like to go, you have those options to help. You can also support us at the actual deployment site. So if you're wanting to help us with managing, getting people ready and out the door to be able to conduct the survey, you're welcome to do that as well.
Is there training that is needed, or do you just sign up and then you can just go ahead?
No, there's definitely training because, you know, we want to make sure people are aware of this, of how to conduct the actual survey. But also we're asking people to go meet folks in their spaces, in their homes, and, you know, the respect and how to approach people. And if they do not want to be surveyed, you know, how to respect that. And so there's a pretty in-depth training that is done just to help folks understand how to engage in the actual count and the surveying.
You mentioned that you added satellite locations outside of just, you know, the city proper. You mentioned areas like Citrus Heights. What went into selecting these locations for the point in time count?
Well, we really just asked our surrounding cities if they wanted to participate and have an option to have satellite locations. So three of the major cities will have them on one of the two nights. Folsom will be conducting a count in the morning, so that one is not as accessible to volunteers, but the other three. So we've received really good participation from our surrounding jurisdictions. Obviously, the city and county are very involved in the development of the pit, but wanting to make sure that all of our region is having an opportunity to partake.
Are there any requirements to be a volunteer?
Main requirement is that you're over 18. You're going to have a vehicle, or someone has to have a vehicle to be able to drive, and preferably that you have a smartphone so that you can download the application.
Yeah, you did mention there is an app. So tell us about it and how this actually helped streamline the process for you.
Well, one thing that it does for us is it's giving us real-time data. So as people are out on the street counting and surveying, we are collecting that information in real time. So we can see very quickly how the count is going, if there's any issues, you know. And so it's a much better way for us to connect immediately with the teams in terms of the work that they're doing out on the field.
Mm. You're also partnering with a company. It's called Simtech Solutions. What is their role in this?
Simtech is a national company that is really reinforcing the methodology that we're using in order to make sure that we have an accurate count. They are also supplying the application that is on the phones that we're using, and they're providing insights from how other communities across the nation are conducting their counts. So they were selected in part because of their national presence and their work in many other communities and their deep work with the federal government around point-in-time counts.
I know that this count is so crucial to get really an accurate snapshot at how those experiencing homelessness, this population, is evolving and changing within Sacramento County. the last count, as I led with, was unprecedented. It was over 9,000 people experiencing homelessness on any given night. Anecdotally, given that, you know, you are vested in this issue, do you think these numbers might be better or might be in line with 2022? What does it look like in Sacramento County right now?
Yeah, I think what we've seen nationally and in California is, and this was just released, is that there continues to be rises in homelessness nationally and certainly in California. So I think the point in time count will give us a sense of how much change will we see in Sacramento this time around. There's been a number of efforts and programs and initiatives that have been put in place with the city and the county and the COC that, at least on some of our other data, are showing some impressive or movements that may temper increases, but we don't know until we conduct that point in time count.
Lisa, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Lisa Bates is the Chief Executive Officer of Sacramento Steps Forward, talking to us about the biennial point in time count. They are looking for a few hundred more volunteers. We have more information on our website. The point in time count is happening in Sacramento County at the end of the month. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. And if you want to join the conversation, you can email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Lashinsky and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer and audio engineer is Chris Feltz. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. And our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.